February today because there's been things in the paper and such things, people saying that students in New Mexico politics in particular has not been presenting both sides of the story and these instructor firings and other things like this. And so, well, what we get, there's more people concerned with the Students in Action Politics and other organizations like the Durham Residents, Black Students Union, the Iranian Students Association, and Ecology Action Committee got together and talked about this. And we decided to ask Dr. Kennedy to come before you and present possibly some facts that haven't been brought out before. Not necessarily the other side of the story, but another side of what's been happening. We have Dr. Kennedy here, and four people representing Students in Action Politics. That's myself, John Mason, representing Ecology Action Committee, Daniel Zogi, representing foreign students, and Michael Dillon, representing the Durham residents. I have the, I can start off here with the first question from Dr. Kennedy.
Ray, would you like
to
make a couple of statements?
Morning at 9 o'clock with representatives of the four student organizations that have been named. And we discussed what in fact would be the format of this meeting this morning. And I asked what were the major issues. The four student representatives said that the main issues that they wanted to talk about was foreign student tuition, the Brana case, the Dr. Riso case, and open and closed door controversy in connection with the residence halls, in connection with some of the personnel cases. We may, in fact, because one of the comments that Mr. Group made to us in this meeting this morning, want to elaborate on procedures and policies of the college regarding the selection, retention, reappointment, termination, tenure provisions of the college, grievance procedures, etc. And this I welcome, that we can do this. Now, one of the things that we did agree was that this morning the four students who were present in the room would in fact leave and prepare a set of questions, each of them on the subject that they had agreed would be of most interest to their particular group. And as I understand it, and I'd like to have them in this order if I can get them, because I think it would facilitate our discussion. Mr. Hassan Kadrad, representing the Iranian Student Association, said that he was going to arrange whether he was going to ask the questions himself, but arrange to ask some questions about foreign student tuition. Then Mr. John Mason, who was president of the Ecology Action Committee, was going to ask some questions about Mr. Brana's case. And Mr. Raymond Groot, President of Staff, was going to ask some questions about the Riso case and perhaps expand that in connection with general policies and procedures on personnel. And then Mr. Michael Dillon of the Ad Hoc Dorm Residence Group would ask questions on residence hall rules pertaining to visitation. So if I might, I'd like to have the question now on the foreign student tuition.
Dr. Kennedy, will you publicly state that you will actively research for sources of increased aid for foreign students who may otherwise have to drop out of school because of the recent tuition fees? Would you lend public support to a drive to help raise this money in the community?
Well, the last time I did this, everybody wanted me to answer yes, and now the answer is yes.
Will you also publicly state that foreign students have the same rights as American citizens to express their opinions publicly on campus, particularly if they disagree with some American foreign policy or action?
Yes.
You stated on the radio on Sunday that you are against the tuition rates that would affect foreign students. A month ago during the talent show, you sent Mr. Miller some foreign students to tell us that if we insult the audience, you would, one, walk out of the show to show your resentment, to raise hell later on. What exactly did you mean by raise hell? Could it have anything to do with the recent rise in the tuition fee?
No, it had nothing to do with the recent rise in the tuition fee. Now, I think that, is that maybe all the questions you have on the tuition fee? Let me talk about the tuition fee for a moment so that you'll understand. The question regarding the tuition fee has been misunderstood in terms of the last action of the Board of Trustees. The Board of Trustees did, in fact, write into the regulations regarding the $1,100, what is both an out-of-state and a foreign student tuition fee, a grandfather clause. The grandfather clause will provide for any student currently enrolled, as long as he continues to make progress toward a bachelor's degree, will not be subject to the $1,100 fee, but will be subject only to the fee that was established previous to that, which was $600. This does not mean, though, that new incoming foreign students will have that provision. They will be required to pay, effective as of this last quarter, the winter quarter of 71, I should say, the $1,100 fee. Now, I think that all the foreign students who are here enrolled now should recognize the fact that while their problem may be financially more difficult than it was previously, when there was an out-of-state, the foreign students did not pay the same fee as did the out-of-state students, the American-born out-of-state students from other states in the United States. It will not be as serious a problem as had been thought originally when it appeared that the $1,100 tuition fee would be applied basically retroactively to anyone who was then enrolled. Now, the question that you asked about the International Education Night and wanted to know what I did, I didn't do anything. I sat in the audience and I watched the presentation of the Iranian Student Association. I listened to what Mr. Miller did, in fact, say at the intermission break as a part of the presentation. I did, in fact, agree with Dr. Miller's statements, which he made at that time, which was an admonition to the audience that they should recognize the fact that the presentation by some of the students, foreign organizations, might be objectionable to many of the people in the audience because they could, in fact, be considered quite critical of the American people, not just the American government, but the American people. And some of the things that many of our foreign students do not realize is that the government in Washington or the government in Sacramento does, in fact, at any one time represent what through the election procedures used in this country would be classified as a majority. It's oftentimes a very small majority. And there is, as you all know, a somewhat militant minority in the United States. Now, one of the privileges that we have in the United States is that the militant minority is permitted to speak out. And it should continue to speak out. I think that the questions that pertain to tuition, I think, have been answered. I hope that the foreign students recognize the fact that we will do everything we can to help those foreign students who are presently enrolled to meet the $600 tuition fee, and that we will do what we can to assist those new foreign students who will, in fact, be coming in to find sources of income that will assist them. Now, as I understand it, Mr. John Mason would be ready to make a presentation on his question.
John Mason, a college action. And I basically want to ask Mr. Kennedy a few questions just to clear up some matters I think that are unclear. And my first question is, when Mr. Braun was up for reevaluation, was he given the same opportunity to receive tenure if he got his PhD as those who were up for reevaluation at the same time did?
Yes, he got the same evaluation, except that you have to remember that evaluation took place a year ago because Mr. Branham during this last year has been serving on what is called a fifth notice year. He was denied tenure in December 1st of 1969. And at the time that his tenure was denied, I sent him a reappointment letter which notified him that he was being given a fifth year. And this is strictly permissive. The college president is not required to give a faculty member denied tenure a fifth year of employment. We are required only to give him the notification that occurs and amounts to approximately 9 months. In fact, Mr. Branagh had, through the fifth notice year, 19 months notice that his appointment would end in June of this year.
Well, Mr. Kennedy, my question, was he given the same opportunity to be granted tenure if he got his PhD?
Yes, before then, you see, you threw that evaluation in there. What I'm concerned about is whether people understand that during a fifth notice year, a faculty member is not evaluated. During this last year, he was not evaluated in any way in terms of his continuing employment. He was evaluated before December of 1969, and the decision was made then not to grant him tenure. Now,
was he given the opportunity then to get tenure if he obtained his PhD? That's why I'm asking. Maybe I should say that earlier.
Yes. The question that is difficult for me to follow is that we are concerned here with a case in which it probably would be best if you let me go back and take it chronologically. Do you have any objection to me taking it chronologically in connection with Mr. Vanna's case in terms of what I did? Do you want to know what I did about this and why or not? We'll make it. I don't intend to start very far. It is true that the tenured members of the faculty in the physics department did in fact recommend Mr. Branagh for tenure. His department head did in fact recommend Mr. Branagh for tenure. It went to the normal process of a personnel review board, and we can talk about that in terms of procedures after a while. And the personnel review board said that they in fact upheld and did find no procedural problems related to this, and so there was no contradiction here. The dean of the school, Dr. Clyde Fisher, had a difference of opinion, but these were based upon his evaluation of Mr. Branagh's teaching, Mr. Branagh's academic qualifications. And I was concerned with one thing that needs to be spelled out here, because it is no reflection on Mr. Branagh. I have said this before, and I say it now. I think that Mr. Branagh is a fine teacher, and I have every desire to maintain him in the department and in the college. And I have, in fact, offered him reemployment. And I have offered it to him in a way which I'll explain in a moment. But let me say what I then did. I had been involved in an accreditation team visit regarding accreditation for the School of Engineering. The School of Engineering had asked for and had received from the Engineering Council of Professional Development a visit from a team of experts from other colleges and from industry that came here and looked over the engineering school. But they also look over all of the other areas of the college that do in fact support engineering, and this included mathematics, physics, chemistry, and including the general education program too. And in an exit interview which they had with me, they made it very plain that while the Engineering Council for Professional Development's accreditation was going to be positive for the five departments for which we asked for accreditation, we would be up for reaccreditation in 5 years. But during that 5 year period, we had to make definite progress in a number of different programs in order to strengthen not only those programs, but also the programs that they support, such as engineering. And they pointed out specifically that in the physics department, which now is a major department offering its own degree, asking for and having been recommended to offer a master's degree in physics, that of 15 tenured members of that department, 13 did not have a doctorate. And they thought that this was a very serious deficiency, and that they asked that I do something about it. Well, the one thing that I could do about it was to make sure that no additional members of the department become tenured members until they had, in fact, earned the doctorate. Mr. Branagh and there were other members that came up at that same time, and these people were advised of the problem. I went back to the physics department, talked to them with the dean. Are we still on? And we explained in considerable detail what this particular issue was. So there's no question in my mind that Mr. Branagh, because I talked to him in my office, knew specifically that the issue was this and this alone. And he then filed a grievance, and he was right in filing a grievance, because our grievance procedure here at the college does in fact indicate that a faculty member should, when he has a situation such as this, file a grievance, and he did. He went before a grievance board that was selected not by me but by the Academic Senate through a procedure that they have developed, and a five-member review panel made up of faculty from all of the five then schools in this institution heard his case and recommended in support of the institution should not be given tenure. So I notified him of that decision, and that basically was theoretically an end to the case. Now, as John Mason knows, College in Action asked to meet with me. Want to discuss the pros and cons, their concern, because, as they said, and I see how they had some possibility of believing this, that they thought there was a relationship because non-retention, not being given tenure, and some actions that he has said, and others have said, that he took in connection with opposing the atomic power plant at the Diablo Canyon, which is a PG&E project. And the inference was that somehow or other PG&E had got to me, and that this was the basic excuse that I was using to not do this. The fact is that the decision made by Dean Fisher and laid on my desk about not giving Mr. Vaughn a tenure, preceded by 3 weeks to a month, the first hearing that occurred at which any public notice was given of Mr. Branagh's position on this. And I might add that the reference by College in Action and other people that somehow or other that Mr. Branagh's position on sex education had a part in it. All I can say is hell, I don't even know what position he takes on sex education. I don't know whether he's for it or against it or what, but the fact, and I don't care. I'm just saying to you that my position was a positive one. Now, after the College in Action Committee met with him, and they had a lot of emotion involved in explaining what a great teacher Mr. Branagh was, and I didn't deny it. Yes, sir. No, just one more second. I wanted to make absolutely certain that they knew that I would give reconsideration to this, and I did. I wrote back to the physics department, and I asked some specific questions of them about would they back me up if I were to promise in a legal document to re-employ Mr. Branagh when he got a doctorate degree in either geology or physical science, and what length of time would they get now in order to get that? They responded and said that their position was the same as it had been originally, in that they would prefer that he be given tenure. On the other hand, they did say that they would support the concept of a reappointment promise at this point, and that they would think that a three-year period would be a desirable and a legitimate length of time for him to work toward a doctorate, since he had already completed, as he has said to many students, a number of graduate units in a number of fields. And so at this point, I have written to him. I promised him that he will have a guaranteed reappointment when he comes back with that earned doctorate, because it is very important for the college as a whole. And that is the story of Mr. Branagh. He has answered me, received the answer today. He says he accepts the concept, but he still thinks that he ought to get tenure. I'm sure that he and I'll have some conversations about it very shortly. John? I thought it was. Sorry.
I want to see that since you didn't have to really talk, I think I have the right to say myself to say a few words besides questions.
I thought, John, in the meeting now, I said that I would answer the questions. You said you would ask the questions, and you said that we would not make speeches. Now, if you want to continue to ask me questions on the Brandon case.
Okay. Are there 18 members at this department right now who have PhDs?
Yes, there are. That doesn't mean anything. Let me put it like this. There's a survey that has just been undertaken by the California State Colleges that say that there are 13 physics departments in the state college system that offer the major, and every one of these departments require that a faculty member, in order to receive tenure, must in fact have an earned doctorate in the physical science or physics or whatever the hardcore subject matter is of that department.
Now, this came to you Friday, and this all took place long before this. I have another question. In light of the fact that you granted tenure to a man in the business department who only obtained a bachelor's degree, and a man in the English department who only had a bachelor's degree in English, I can't really accept your... Do you expect me to accept your reasons for not rehiring my own
job? I really did expect you to understand that there is a 50 different disciplines in this institution, and there are almost that many departments, and each of the departments goes through the process of determining what are the minimum academic requirements for a faculty member for that particular discipline. And all I can say to you is that in certain areas, the terminal degree is not the doctorate degree. In certain other areas, the faculty have considered, and so have other organizations and institutions, even accrediting institutions, certain kinds equal sciences. And particularly in a department of physics, there is an unalterable position on this in terms of the field, and that is that the department of physics does require an earned doctorate or tenure.
More of a speech than an answer to the question.
I think I'll clarify one thing. It might be a misunderstanding on your part. Mr. Verona spoke against the San Luis Obispo County Development Association 3 weeks before he got denied tenure. This is our initial concern. Now, my next question is...
3 weeks before December 1st.
Before he was... certain ones would not be rehired.
Yeah, all right. 3 weeks before he received the letter from me, but I could ask Dr. Clyde Fisher if he wants to. He's out in the audience. He can come here and he can clarify for it when the date that he gave me the recommendation, which was...
because I just met with you February 8th to discuss the Braun case, you made a statement. The final statement was, did you reconsider the Braun case? You reconsidered. 2 weeks later, you made the statement that you would recommend Verona be rehired if he got his PhD, and if there was an opening, when he returned to Cal Poly. Now, my question is this. You have reconsidered a second time, stating that you have sent a letter of intent to Mr. Verona to reemploy him to this college. Does this guarantee that he will be given tenure when he gets back, and will he be remain here?
When he comes back with a doctorate, the faculty of the department has agreed with me that we would obligate ourselves to reemploy him. And that would mean that we would reemploy him at the same rank and class that and step that he is in at the present time, which means that we don't offer him some kind of a less than desirable position. We offer him the same job he has now. All I can say at the present time about whether I can grant him tenure at the moment that he comes back is dependent upon an action that's before the Board of Trustees on the March 23rd meeting, in which they are taking up again the rules and regulations regarding tenure. And if in the approved rules and regulations established by the trustees, if it is possible for me as the president to offer him tenure when he returns, he will be offered tenure. But I have to operate within the rules that have been set forth by the state college trustees for the system. And at the present time, those are up for reconsideration, and I'm not sure what the final outcome will be.
This is where my doubt comes, because in your letter you said you have reassured Ron of a position at this school when he returns, and now you say that he has only offered, he will not be reassured, he is not assured of a problem. This is why...
I didn't say he wasn't assured of a job. I said he was assured of a job. You asked me if I would, if I could reassure you that at the moment that he arrived back on the campus, that he would also be given instant tenure. And my answer to you is, he will be given instant tenure if I can legally do so. Now, how else can I answer that question?
Mr. Kennedy, would you, one final question, would you like this, put this in writing?
I did put it in writing. Well, I don't know. Does Mr. Branagh give you all of his correspondence?
Where?
Does Mr. Branagh give you all his correspondence? Well, let's get on with the question. You remember somebody a moment ago said I was taking too much time.
Thank you.
I hope that you will give serious consideration to my letter, Dr. Kennedy. When you ask John whether he received all of my correspondence, I find that the letter that you wrote me, after making the offer, was a public statement. I first found out when IMDK for the Mustang called me up Sunday afternoon saying that you had released that statement. So it was a matter of public record on your side, too.
Well, Mr. Grant, the letter, as I understood, was hand-delivered to you by Mr. Young. Was it not?
By Mr. Voss.
By Mr. Voss. By Mr. Voss. There was no attempt on my part to do anything about a public statement until I began getting calls from the Mustang and from other press saying that they understood that I had made an offer to Mr. Branagh. What was it?
If you recall, Thursday a week ago, Roy DeGroote mentioned here that you had made such an offer to me. It had come through the channels of the tenured civics department that you would make such an offer, if you recall. I think this is where that story came from.
Well, as all of you can see, there's a lot of room for misunderstandings when you write letters back and forth. Dr. Kennedy, I'd like to... I did press this point. Will you publicly state that all instructors, this is an out-of-class situation, that all instructors should have the right to participate in any political activity or any political party and not have to fear that it will endanger his career as a teacher? Well, what I would publicly state is that they... faculty members on this campus, in regard to their political activities, should in fact abide by a code of ethics that have been established by the Academic Senate and by the American Association of College and University Professors. And that statement regarding political activity does in fact have certain limitations in regard to their role. And that is the statement that I will reaffirm and say that does in fact apply to all of our faculty members, as it does to all of the faculty members at all recognized colleges, universities in the country, where they do, in fact, provide for academic freedom. And I say that the faculty members have a responsibility in connection with academic freedom. It's just a matter of freedom. They've got some responsibility. Those responsibility sections are as well spelled out as are the freedom sections.
In terms of, in the context of this statement,
We still publicly state that an instructor should have the, in the context of these rules, we still publicly state that an instructor should have the right to participate in any political activity or any political party and not have to fear that it will endanger his career.
As long as the activity that you're talking about is within the bonds or bounds of what I just described as the ethical statement regarding responsibilities of, as well as freedoms in the field of academic life. Now, there are some limitations about what a faculty member can do in using his classroom, for example, as a platform to expound upon a particular point of view when it is a political point of view. Right. So I'm just saying, when you say, do I give him freedom to do anything? The fact is, I do give him freedom to do what is within the bonds of the acceptable statement on academic freedom as written for the American Association of College University Professors and for the Statewide Academic Senate, which statement is now being considered on this campus by the Academic Senate.
Do you feel that an item such as an American Legion newsletter is a relevant form of criticism in the evaluation of instructors for tenure or promotion, and that it should be included in his personnel file?
I think that you would have to remember that what happens when people send items to me about a particular faculty member, they are frequently letters of congratulations, saying that they, in fact, want a faculty member, a faculty member has done something particularly good in connection with community service, and I take a simple action when it comes to my desk. I have a little black pen, and most of the people on the staff are quite well aware of what it looks like because it gets Xeroxed, and I just write XCC, means Xerox copy, and I put a slash mark, and I put the dean's name there, and because the dean reports to me, I put the dean who is responsible in that area where that faculty member works, and I put for your information, and I use my initials, R-E-K, and I send it without comment, and it is a lot more frequently that the item is laudatory than it is critical. Now, in the case of the American Legion newsletter, that's a question here, I did it exactly the same thing. I did not ask her to be put in his file. I didn't ask anything. I didn't make any comment on it. I did the same thing that I do on laudatory statements. I merely put to the dean for your information.
This wasn't my question. I thought it was. The question is, do you feel that an item such as an American Legion newsletter is a relevant form of criticism and evaluation of instructors for tenure or promotion, and that it should be included in his personnel file?
I think it is as legitimate as some of the other forms of comment. This particular newsletter was quoting a Mustang article and asking some questions. And it is as prejudiced on one side as are the laudatory statements prejudiced on the other. Why use anything in a man's personnel folder? Why have any student evaluation? Why have any evaluation at all?
The term was a relevant form, but I was asking about.
I think it may have been not relevant. But the question was, should it be sent by me to somebody, or should it be in his folder?
No, the question is it relevant, and should it be included?
Well, it was a form of criticism that perhaps was as appropriate to be in his folder as some of the laudatory letters would be.
Will you publicly denounce the line taken in this American Legion newsletter that stated that Dr. Rizzo's comments in the Mustang Daily were the same as emanated from Hanoi and Peking?
I'd have to read the article.
No.
I didn't read it when I sent it. Let's, you know, we've only got how many hours now? Well, let's get on with the rest of the question. You know, at the meeting we had this morning, just to show you what kind of opportunities we have here for dialogue, I was given to believe that
That's a four individual from the Mustang Daily of the 27th of January, 1970. President Richard Nixon will receive a petition signed by nearly 100 faculty and staff members of Cal Poly, which reads in part, that it is in the national interest of the United States for the President to announce and initiate a clear status, swiftly phased withdrawal of all U.S. armed forces and weapons from Vietnam, so that the Vietnamese themselves may make their own decisions about the future of Vietnam without foreign military interference or intervention. Dr. Fred Rizzo, English instructor and draft counselor, helped author this petition. He was also active in last fall's moratorium demonstrations, according to the Mustang Daily article. Dr. Rizzo has put it further. We've got to get rid of the simple-minded notion that whatever we do on the world scene is right, and whatever the communists do is wrong. Senator J. William Fulbright, in his book, The Artist of Power, saw the foolishness behind these stereotypes of the free world and communism when he said, the view of communism as an evil philosophy is a distorting prism through which we see projections of our own minds rather than what is actually there. Looking through the prism, we see the Viet Cong cut the throats of village chiefs as savage murderers, with American flyers who incinerate unseen women and children with napalm as valiant fighters for freedom. Americans have to remember, he said, that we, not the Vietnamese or the Viet Cong, are by far the greatest offenders in Vietnam. And we're denying young men of draft age here that very freedom of conscience, which we, politically, claim to be defending there. That's strange, but I've heard the same line before. It emanates quite frequently from Hanoi and Peking. These people call the U.S. presence in Vietnam intervention, but the presence of communist troops is called self-determination. From the Observer of 14 January 1970, we read, Donald A. Troffman, an information analyst with the Joint U.S. Public Affairs Office of the United States Department, who specializes in capturing North Vietnamese and Viet Cong documents, says that from data he has gathered, he personally believes that 1 million would be massacred and another million would wish they were dead if the U.S. settlement withdrew. Communism is not an evil philosophy, Dr. Rizzo. Will you publicly...
Now, as I understand, you're quoting directly from the newsletter, the American Legion newsletter?
Yes.
And the newsletter quoted Rizzo all the way to the bottom, right? Was that his quote? That was his quote for everything except part about Rockland was... the rhetorical question was that was the only thing, is that right, at the bottom? Was the rhetorical question?
Beginning with, that is strange, but I have heard that same line before. It emanates quite frequently from Hanoi and Peking. These people call the U.S. presence of Vietnam intervention, but the presence of communist troops is called self-determination. On to the statement about the personal belief that a million would be massacred, another million would wish they were dead if the U.S. withdrew. That is a commentary by the writer of the American Legion newsletter. What I'd like to know is this. Do you or do you not, will you or will you not publicly denounce that statement that says, my line of thought emanates quite frequently from Hanoi and Peking? Will you or will you not denounce that statement by the American Legion?
Yeah. Dr. Rizzo, this line of confrontation that you're developing here, which is beyond the bounds of what I agreed to these young men.
He stated the same question that I asked. That was my question he was stating there.
Will you answer it, please? Clarification. What he wants me to do is to denounce the line that says that some of what he said is the same as what the communists sometimes say. Is that right?
We want you to denounce the line that says, that is strange, but that is, I have heard that same line before. It emanates quite frequently from Hanoi and Peking.
I cannot denounce it because I'm not sure whether it does not sometimes do that. Don't let yourself be a brass tower.
Have you ever been a member of the American Legion?
No, I have not been a member of the American Legion. I have never served my country in a uniform. But that doesn't mean I shouldn't have.
Why are instructors not allowed to attend any evaluation meetings where they could have an opportunity to answer any charges such as this, which might be brought against them?
Would you mind repeating that question?
Why are instructors not allowed to attend their evaluation meetings where they could have an opportunity to answer any charges such as this one in the American Legion newsletter that might be brought against them?
Well, the person that asked the question needs to look at the procedures by which we develop the evaluation in the departments. And it is a matter that is worked out through the Academic Senate on this campus and through the departments. And there is no question but what in the field of evaluation by faculty that we have certain rules and regulations that pertain to who in fact can sit in on the deliberations of the tenured members of the faculty. I think maybe Dr. Erickson, who is the dean of the School of Communicative Arts and Humanities, would be as willing to make a statement as an outside expert that you just called in. Do you mind making a comment on that, Dr. Erickson?
There are just a couple of things I want to say on the matter of the American Legion newsletter. The first is that the tenured faculty in the department did not know about that newsletter and therefore it couldn't have been a part of their deliberations. As far as such newsletters appearing in the future, Dr. Kennedy was asked if he feels it's appropriate to put them in the file. Well, whether he answers yes or no is irrelevant to what's really going to happen, because I'm going to put them in the file. And I'll make the decision whether they're going to be filed. Responsibility. I'm not sure if I said if I put it in or not, if it happened tomorrow, but if it happens tomorrow, the answer is yes. A reason for the answer being yes is a part of my responsibility is to protect faculty members.
In my file, documents in their personnel files.
Yes, in my file at Central Washington State College, there is a letter from a right-wing organization. It doesn't happen to be the American Legion. But it was written after I debated against American involvement in Vietnam back in 1966. I presume I've been at least as active as Dr. Rizzo in that matter, which leads to another implication. But that's in my file. It squarely calls me not simply espousing the communist line of Peking and Hanoi, but specifically lists me out as a communist. When I was hired here, the school asked no questions, nor did the committee that interviewed me, about my political views. Those political views are my business. As far as the implications then, since I'm the one, and I mean the one, who made a negative decision on Dr. Rizzo, I was the one who knew about that newsletter. I asked Dr. Rizzo, what do you think that means to me? Is it positive or negative? Well, you can answer that question for yourself. Well, I think it's made up of the positive negative. If you want to ask me further questions about the real reasons, the factual reasons for Rizzo's non-retention, I'd be happy to give them.
I would like to repeat my original question to Dr. Kennedy before this gentleman came up here.
That gentleman is Dr. John Erickson, Dean of the School of Communicative Arts and Humanities.
Why are instructors not allowed to attend their own evaluation meetings where they could have an opportunity to answer any charges such as this letter that might be brought against them?
He has had an opportunity because he filed a grievance, and through the Academic Senate and the State College System's grievance procedure, a random number selection of faculty members, tenured faculty members, were selected, and Mr. Reza went through the process of procedure of making two peremptory challenges, changing the membership of that committee so that he had the three members that he thought would be as good as he could get, I suppose. I made no peremptory challenges. The three-member committee reviewed his case. They sent a recommendation to me that said that there was no justification for a further grievance hearing. That ended the case.
In other words,
he was,
case,
unless he wants to take it off campus.
He was not allowed to attend the meeting to answer the charges.
Pardon?
Was he allowed to attend this meeting to answer the charges? Or did the grievance committee in fact say that we are not going to have a hearing on this case?
You were talking originally of the tenured members of the English Department Committee meeting, in which they make decisions about reappointment and tenure for people who are on probation. This is what your question was about in the beginning.
This is my question originally, yes.
Right. Well, and I'm saying that the procedure does not provide for that, and specifically excludes the people who are under consideration for being involved with the tenured members in that meeting. That doesn't mean that they can't be called into a meeting and have an opportunity to talk, and in some departments they are. I don't know what happened in the English department in regard to whether he ever had a chance to talk or whether he didn't have a chance to talk. Well, it's fine. But it's the prerogative of the department and the academic center of the institution to set up the procedures by which these evaluations are made. See, you're... The fact is that... Now let's talk about the crimes that you're accused of. I think I'd like to have John Erickson, now that Dr. Reese has talked about it, come over here and explain what is the issues at stake.
This will be good, I think, because John and I will be able to just have a dialogue with one another.
Not at all. The question is whether Dr. Rizzo was fired, not retained, for political reasons. I want to make a short statement on that, perhaps Fred.
Would your short statement be a little bit shorter than Dr. Kennedy's, where he had a tendency to give a nice long speech?
When one talks about Dr. Rizzo, the man deserves a little time.
I take that as
Dr. Rizzo came to this college in 1969 with good academic qualifications. Dr. Rizzo, in his first year here, was involved in a number of political activities. One of them he's mentioned speaking in the park about the Vietnam War. The second one he's mentioned is his willingness to counsel people concerned with the draft. The only criticism made of his activities is that he should not counsel draftees, potential draftees, in his office on safe time, and he shouldn't use the mimeograph machine. Those are some of the same rules that obtained to me as a dean when I looked around the college for a place to print a Christmas letter. It's against the rules, and one doesn't do it. Dr. Rizzo responded courteously in writing, and apologize for not knowing what the rules were.
May I just comment just briefly on that? Now the administration has Manny and Bob Simone doing official draft counseling for the students, and he uses college facilities consistently.
I will limit my remarks to the facts in the Rizzo case. Historically, I'm talking now about last year. The big fat fact and the little piece of granite that Rizzo has to chew upon is that after those activities in 1969 and 1970, his department made a response to those activities by voting that he be retained, and not only that he be retained, but they did to me what I regard as an administrative error, that is to recommend a first-year man. They thought so highly of Rizzo after his first year that they thought he ought to be promoted.
If I were here as a dean, then I wouldn't have voted affirmatively on that promotion. Indeed, the dean didn't then, because I simply don't think it's good policy to promote people after their first year. Okay, what happened in the second year Friezo was here? As far as I know, I may be wrong on this, there were no political activities, at least none that came to my attention. One thing did come to everyone's attention, however, and that is that Dr. Rizzo refused to teach the schedule of courses that he was given by his department and his department head. Now, this is important. Rizzo doesn't want to teach freshman courses. He wants to teach...
I have since agreed to teach whatever courses are assigned. I wrote that to you, I wrote that to Dr. Kennedy, I wrote that to Willard Peterson. It's been made public in the Mustang Daily. If my credentials are so high and I've agreed to teach courses, why haven't I been reappointed?
When we are talking about reasons which led to a November decision, I cannot here cope with what Fred Rizzo says he's willing to do in the future. I think everyone here would understand that.
I don't.
I'm talking about the reason, the facts, the reason for non-retention. Now, if it's Fred Rizzo, or if it's anyone else, if it's a tenured faculty member in that English department who is going to say, I am not going to teach freshman courses, they will not receive my support for retention. And I say that goes for people who now hold tenure. As far as beginning teachers are concerned, if someone comes here next year, the year after that, and tells that English department, who's composed of a fine group of senior scholars, that I am going to pick and choose what I'm going to teach, they will not be retained.
Okay, now, staying here because students have to go off.
Give me one more minute, and then you can have your say. There's two reasons. And this is the colossal irony of this, you see, because any person in the past, future, takes that kind of position, identifies him not with any kind of liberal attitude, but with what in the 19th century used to be called aristocracy, and what in this century is called the right-wing establishment. Because either you're doing this, that is, I won't teach courses, for practical reasons. And if it's for practical reasons, okay, let him try to make his case there, let anyone try. Because it's awfully hard work and it takes an awful lot of time to teach those freshman courses.
I'm willing to do it.
It isn't done for that, it's presumptuousness. That is, because of my unusual academic qualifications as a beginning teacher, there are other people in the department who ought to really carry the chores around here. Actually, I shouldn't be expected to do it. Now, if that's the position, either that or the practical matter of the amount of work, the man is not going to be retained. In the past, in the present, or in the future.
Okay.